Okay, thank you for the invitation and thank you for coming. This is going to be a rather general talk, not for the specialists in the audience. I will give a more specialized talk on some other on some
somewhat related things tomorrow.
But today I'm going to give a talk about black holes.
And the thesis of this talk is the role that black holes are playing in many different areas, surprising role that they're playing in many different areas of modern physics. And the analogy I want to make is that in the 20th century, the 20th century was really, as far as physics was concerned, the century of the harmonic oscillator. And many problems in physics were beat on until they could somehow be reduced to a harmonic oscillator or a big series of coupled harmonic oscillators. And perhaps the pinnacle of this would be the standard model of a strong and electroweak physics, which we describe in quantum field theory as some huge set of coupled harmonic oscillator, all the many different, infinitely many modes of space-time of the field in space-time that are coupled. But many other problems, the hydrogen atom, superconductivity, were some approximation would be looked for that would turn it into a harmonic oscillator. And you know, I think I'm missing the top and the bottom of my. Yes, I'm missing the top and the bottom. Is the computer guy still here? He's gone? Oh, he just fixed it. Okay, great. Yeah, better. So I'd say that black holes, not every problem is equivalent to a harmonic oscillator. There are other things that happen in the world around us. And there are new kinds of things that we're beginning, qualitatively new kinds of things that we're beginning to understand. And black holes are poised to play a similar role in the 21st century that harmonic oscillators played in the 20th. And what is so kind of special about black holes? Well, what's special about black holes is that they're at once the simplest and the most complicated objects in the physical universe. So in what sense are they simple? Well, in the Schwarzschild solution, which represents a black hole is literally a hole in space. So it's simpler than empty space. It's really nothing. It's something which is so simple that we wouldn't have even imagined something that simple before the black holes were found. And they're featureless. They're characterized just by a few quantities, the mass, charge, and the angular momentum. On the other hand, according to the work of Bekenstein and Hawking, they have an incredibly large number of microstates. In fact, it's widely believed that the number of microstates that a black hole contains saturates some kind of universal upper bound. And so it's very puzzling how something can be both maximally simple and maximally complex at the same time. Yet we've come to some kind of glimpse of an understanding of how that's possible. And this, our understanding of this has had implications both for the black holes for themselves and for other problems in physics. So here's a cartoon of progress in physics. So when I was a graduate student, my advisor told me to take two-dimensional QCD and beat it up until I could turn it into a large harmonic oscillator wave function, which I did, and then he gave me a thesis. Now, having learned from my advisor,
I give problems to my students and tell them to turn it into a black hole. So here's the outline of this talk. First, I'm going to give a kind of history of the black hole. And I want to emphasize how what a surprising object it is. That we still don't understand it. It was surely not understood when it was discovered in 1916. And I wrote 1915 there. Maybe it was late in 1915. And I'll review that. I'll talk about some of the things that we've learned about black holes and some applications in it. I won't be talking much about string theory directly, but string theory is kind of lurking behind the scenes in the first part of the talk, and I'll bring that out at the end and talk about both the role of string theory and how I view string theory as fitting into modern physics. Okay, so it's said that when Einstein discovered his famous field equations in 1915, he thought they were so complicated and nonlinear that nobody would ever be able to find an exact solution of those equations. Yet, just a few months later, Schwarzschild found the famous Schwarzschild solution to the Einstein equation, and he made the statement, and I think perhaps truer words were never spoken, it is always pleasant to have an exact solution in simple form at your disposal, as if this was some sort of curiosity that was a convenient thing to have. And then Schwarzschild was, I think he discovered the solution while fighting on the Russian front, and he contracted pemphigus and died just a few months later, not knowing what he had left the world. And here is what he left the world, the famous Schwarzschild solution. And one thing really peculiar about this is I think all of us, one has the experience that when you formulate the question precisely, you're halfway to solving the problem. When you find the explicit analytic solution, you're 99% of the way. And then the interpretation just sort of comes right out after that. Not so with the Schwarzschild solution. Nobody had any idea what this meant. In particular, the meaning of the horizon. This is the metric for Schwarzschild. The meaning of the horizon, that is the radius, the Schwarzschild radius, where r is equal to 2gm, what that's supposed to mean. And trying to understand what this very simple equation that can be written on one line means has been really kind of an incredible comedy. People have gone back and forth, and even to this day, people are arguing about what this formula means. Then what happened? Well, so it was thought to be kind of a curiosity, and the horizon, the surface r equals 2gm, was thought not to be very significant. But then in the 30s, Chandrasekhar and Oppenheimer and Snyder showed that if you have a star with a mass greater than 3 times the mass of the sun, it will collapse into a black hole. And Einstein actually disagreed with this and wrote a paper saying so. He said that, actually what he said was that there would be a firewall and you couldn't actually make a black hole. He should be credited with the first paper on firewalls. And then in the 50s, not until the 50s did the idea, 40 years after this thing was discovered, it's really odd because when I teach general relativity, and you set it up the right way. You write down the black hole solution, and it's 5 or 10 minutes to, when you look at it the right way, it's very simple now to understand that the surface, R equals 2GM, is an event horizon, and that things can cross it from the outside, but not from the inside, because it's moving at the speed of light. But this very simple thing, which it's hard to see how that could not have been understood, but it wasn't. And it took 40 years, and a lot of very smart people tried to understand it, but they couldn't. And so that started in the 50s, and that was kind of the beginning of our modern understanding of what a black hole is. And then another really important milestone was Kerr's discovery of the rotating Kerr solution, which was a really one of the great triumphs in mathematical physics in the 20th century. And not only the triumph in mathematical physics, but now, many years later, there are all kinds of experimental verifications of the Kerr formula. Then in the 60s, the people like Penrose and Hawking and Carter understood more things about the inevitability of the singularities, inevitability of black hole, of gravitational collapse, understood in a more detailed way than Finkelstein and Kruskal had the various kinds of causal structure around a black hole. 67, Wheeler coined the word black hole. Then, for a moment, the field seemed to be kind of mature and the story seemed to be coming to an end in the 70s, and two things happened. One is that astrophysical candidates, including Cygnus X1, began to appear in the sky. Now, it was a matter of decades. You know, it's been a kind of adiabatic process where the astrophysical evidence has gotten better and better. Now I think it's very hard to find somebody who will deny the existence, astrophysical existence of black holes. But it was beginning then. And now we know, or we strongly expect, that there's a huge one right in the middle of our galaxy that we're orbiting about as we speak, Sagittarius A star. And at the same time, well, that was discovered more recently, but at the same time, the classical story of black holes began to become a kind of cohesive, coherent subject. And the properties of black holes it found could be characterized by a set of laws. And they were called the first law of classical black hole dynamics. And that says if you have a black hole of mass E, charge Q, and angular momentum J, if you perturb it and let it settle back down, the area will change according to this formula. It would be related to the change in the energy, change in the charge, and the change in the angular momentum by this so-called first law of black hole dynamics, and this is the surface gravity of the black hole, which is a measure of the strength of the gravitational field. And it was noticed at that time that, that this formula looks just like the first law of ordinary thermodynamics, and that was believed by most people at the time, except for probably Bekenstein, that was believed to just be some sort of odd coincidence. Now, these laws turn into one another, the first law of thermodynamics and the first law of black hole dynamics. If you exchange the entropy with the area, the thermodynamic entropy with the area of the black hole, together with the thermodynamic temperature and the surface gravity of the black hole. Then there was also the second law of black hole dynamics, which said that the area was always non-decreasing in any process evolving in a black hole. And that again looks like the second law of thermodynamics if one exchanges entropy with area. So this was all early 70s. Now, the area of a black hole, it's more subtle and more interesting and delicate than this. But roughly speaking, the area only increases because things can go into a black hole, but they can't go out. On the other hand, thermodynamic entropy only increases because it's a measure, as Boltzmann explained to us, it's a measure of molecular disorder, or as Boltzmann conjectured and was much later understood to be the case, because it measures the molecular disorder, and when you interact with a system, you always increase its disorder. So these look like really just kind of spectacularly different phenomena. They don't seem to be related in any way. But the wonderful surprise that we'll be coming to is that they're in fact the same phenomena in disguise. And that came out from the work of Hawking. And in 1974, Hawking completed the circle, and he showed that in fact the surface gravity of the black hole, which was appearing in the first law of black hole dynamics, in the same way that the temperature appears in the ordinary law of thermodynamics, is in fact a temperature. And that black holes radiate, and they radiate at a temperature given, they radiate black body radiation at a temperature given by the surface gravity over 2 pi. And then if you integrate this relationship, you find that it implies that a black hole, that the area of a black hole can be identified with 4 times its entropy. And Bekenstein had earlier been saying that the area of a black hole should be related to its entropy just because it's a measure of the ignorance about what's inside the black hole. So this left us with, the temptation is to identify a quarter of the area with an ordinary entropy and to write a generalized second law in which one takes this the temperature of the system, which we now must be equal to the surface gravity in equilibrium because of Hawking's work, times the change not just in the black hole entropy, but in all the entropy, black hole plus ordinary matter entropy, and that should be related to the change in the energy of the entire system in this way. In other words, we should think not about the separate black hole and matter entropy, but we want to think about both of them together, and it's their sum that is non-decreasing. So the separate second laws are no longer valid in a quantum mechanical world with gravity. The area, the black hole entropy, is no longer non-decreasing because the black hole can evaporate and shrink. On the other hand, as Bekenstein stressed, it's no longer true when you have a black hole around that the entropy in the visible universe, the matter entropy in the visible universe, is non-decreasing because you can throw something carrying entropy into a black hole and it's no longer part of the observable universe. But in both of these processes, in the first one, in both of these processes, the sum, it can be seen that the sum of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy and the ordinary matter entropy is non-decreasing. So that's kind of amazing that it works out, but it's a very unsatisfying situation. It's unsatisfying because we have two different kinds of entropy. the black hole entropy, which we think of geometrically as the area of the horizon, and the ordinary thermodynamic entropy, which we think of as the log, according to statistical mechanics, as the log of some set of microstates. And again, this generalized second law, we have two different derivations of it, which are valid in two extreme limits. In the limit where quantum mechanics is not important and there's only gravity, we have the Hawking-Penrose area theorem that says it always increases. And in situations where there's no gravity, we have Boltzmann's derivation. So really, we want a unified picture of this, and everything would be good if we could identify the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is given by this area formula, as the logarithm of some kind of microstates of a black hole, whatever those might be. Now, this is really kind of an amazing formula, because if you look at it, first of all, it's not a squiggle here. It's an equals, and there's a number. There's a 4. So it's something very precise. Moreover, it relates three of the main areas of modern physics. We've got statistical mechanics. We've got the area and units of Newton's constant. That's gravity. And we've got quantum mechanics. And there's a very simple formula that relates them. And moreover, it's incredibly universal. It applies not just to black hole horizons, but also cosmological horizons. And indeed, in the cosmological context, it's been argued that the associated temperature has been measured in the form of the fluctuations of the cosmic microwave background. So it applies to cosmology. It also applies even to observer horizons for accelerated observers. So it's an incredibly universal formula. It affects all of physics. And the best thing about it is we really don't understand it. You know, we understand pieces of it in specific contexts, but the universality of this formula is really a big mystery. And so that gives all of us a lot of work to do. So
this was a puzzle.
Trying to understand how this you could get this as a log of a number of microstates. Some progress was made on this using string theory. So in string theory, because it's purports to be a complete quantum theory of gravity, it is incumbent on string theory to resolve this puzzle and give a microstate accounting. And so that led people to work on this problem and to try to make it work. And it turned out that in 1996, a construction was given. A transformation was found, which was shown to preserve the number of microstates, but they were described in an alternate way. And this was for special black holes that were supersymmetric in five dimensions, and they were described as a two-dimensional conformal field theory. Now, this led to a long story. The near horizon was anti-de Sitter space. This was a long story going into string theory. That's not the story I want to talk about today. Actually, I want to more stress more sort of a universal long distance physics. And when this calculation was first done, it seemed like it really was a very specific calculation that was done in string theory, and that you needed all the twos and pis and dimensions of moduli spaces of curves, and all kinds of ingredients seemed to have to be exactly lined up in the right place. in order for it to work. And so it seemed like it was sort of evidence for it, this isn't exactly wrong, but maybe it's a little too simple to say it this way. It appeared as if it was some kind of evidence for string theory. But a few years later, it was realized that if you had any, that it had to work. I mean, everybody's familiar with this thing that you do a calculation in some really complicated way, and then you do it again, and you do it in a simpler way, and you seem to need to assume less and less, and you find more and more streamlined ways of doing the computation. So eventually it turned out that this computation could be done for these special five-dimensional supersymmetric black holes without actually using string theory. That it followed from work of Brown and Hanau, and plus some symmetry arguments, and Cardy's formula, and conformal field theory. And it had to work for any theory which had these special kind of black holes as solutions, as long as it was a consistent quantum theory of gravity. And we should have expected this. And we should have expected this because of universality. Black holes are big objects. You know, they can be big. And we shouldn't need to know the details of Sagittarius A star is, you know, a million miles across. We shouldn't have to know about physics at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters to understand why it has an entropy that is a quarter of its area. And to give an analogy, you know, Boltzmann, he needed to know, you know, Boltzmann, when he did the thermodynamics, you know, continuous media don't have thermodynamics. You can't count the number of modes or degrees of freedom of a continuous medium. There's an ultraviolet problem, an ultraviolet catastrophe, and he needed an ultraviolet cutoff. He needed a theory of molecules. But he didn't need the periodic table. And he didn't even need to know how big the molecules were. He had no idea how big the molecules were. So he needed a little bit of knowledge about the microphysics, needed to know that there was some sort of consistent completion, and a very minimal amount about its form, but nothing detailed. So what was done in string theory was a little bit like first computing the periodic table, and then computing the energy levels of you know, a gas of all the molecules in the periodic table. That was the analog of, and then taking some long distance limit of that. So in string theory, much more work was done than was needed, and indeed much more information was produced. And when you strip it to its bare essence, string theory had almost nothing to do with it. Okay, now, so of course we don't see supersymmetric five-dimensional black holes up in the sky. And one wants to, once this basic mechanism for understanding where microstates come from can be abstracted from string theory, of course one would like to apply it to black holes which are seen up in the sky. And there's been a small amount of success in that for a very special kind of black hole that have been seen, and these are the extreme Kerr black holes. So extreme Kerr black hole, as Kerr showed, there's a limit on how fast a black hole can spin, and that limit is roughly speaking when the horizon of the black hole is moving at the speed of light. And when that happens, the angular momentum is the square of the mass, and the Hawking temperature is zero, but there's still a non-zero Bekenstein Hawking entropy, and which is just 2 pi times the angular momentum in units of h bar. Now, such things have been seen up in the sky. McClintock et al., probably the most studied black hole, oddly enough, in the galaxy, has a spin to mass ratio which is within 2% of extremality. Brenneman and Reynolds, by looking at iron lines, they've reported that there's a nearby galaxy with within 1% of extremality. So here's an artist's rendition of, and I'm going to show a movie in a second. Here's an artist's rendition of GRS 1915. And what they see is, so the black hole is here. There's jets coming out of it. Another amazing characteristic feature of spinning black holes that we don't understand is these jets, these very highly collimated jets that spout out. And the black hole sits in the middle of here. There's a companion star which feeds hot matter onto an accretion disk, which spirals in until it reaches this innermost stable circular orbit, the ISCO, and then the matter plunges in. And what they measure is X-rays of the hot gas coming from the disk. And it turns out that, and they measure their redshift, and from their redshift, they can determine the ratio of the mass to the angular momentum. Now, it turns out that when it's at extremality, which is exactly what we're interested in, when it's at extremality, the redshift goes to infinity, right at the edge, at the ISCO, at the edge of the accretion disk. And so because of that, it's actually easier to measure the ratio. So this ratio of mass, which is the thing we're interested in, the ratio of the angular momentum to the mass squared is much easier to measure than either the mass or the angular momentum itself. The mass or the angular momentum of this guy is only known to within a factor of 2. Now, we don't want to study this whole complicated story. We want to study, let's see what happens. Yeah, we want to study this thing in the near, there it goes. Oh, but there's no sound. All right. Okay, so NASA prepared this video where they're zooming in. So that's GRS 1915 in the middle. They're zooming in there, and they're doing a scaling limit, which is exactly what we want to do, right into the very center of the edge of the horizon there of the black hole, of the highly rotating black hole. Now, what's good about that region? Well, if you have a rotating black hole, so if that projector were a rotating black hole and it were rotating slowly, I would actually, there would be a force trying to drag me around. And I would actually have to walk slowly in this direction in order to stay at the same angle. And the faster it was spinning, the faster I'd have to run to stay in the same place. And of course, the closer I got, also the faster I'd have to run. And an extreme Kerr black hole has the peculiar fact that everything at the horizon, anything which stay, any excitations at the horizon, are forced to move around with the black hole at the speed of light. Now, so I'm going to tell you in a minute that there's a connection with a two-dimensional conformal field theory, and I'm not going to be able to describe that in a lot of detail. It's in our papers. But a two-dimensional, a conformal field theory is essentially a two-dimensional field theory where everything moves at the speed of light. And so here we see already, we can see qualitatively without looking at detail in the equations, this is why a conformal field theory is coming out of this, because all the excitations, if we want to describe the dynamics in that region, are moving around at the speed of light. And it's very hard to move at the speed of light.
And that greatly constrains the dynamics. And so we're used to the idea in condensed matter theory, and possibly there will be more of this in astrophysics and condensed matter theory, particle physics, you don't try to understand everything at once. You try to understand special situations which are extreme limits which exhibit critical behavior. And a lot of simplifying things can occur in those cases, and you can really understand them a lot better analytically than the general case. And often, in extreme situations, you can have critical behavior and you get extra symmetries. And that is exactly what happens here in the near horizon region of these extreme Kerr black holes. You get an infinite dimensional conformal symmetry. And it's not dissimilar. It's also known in the laboratory that if you have a quantum Hall fluid on a disk, that at the boundary of the disk, you also get an emergent infinite dimensional symmetry, which turns out to be exactly the same symmetry as you get in this case. It's a very sort of ubiquitous symmetry. So at this point, in this region, you can show, just from the diffeomorphism group, that dynamics in this region is governed by an infinite dimensional conformal symmetry, and that algebra has a number associated with it which you can compute. And that enables you to understand a lot about the dynamics of that region. And in particular, understanding it as a conformal field theory, any conformal field theory, there's a universal formula discovered by Cardy that relates that number associated with a conformal field theory with its degeneracy of states. And so that enables us to directly count the microstates in the near horizon region of the Kerr black hole. And this microscopic counting agrees with the Bekenstein, agrees exactly, and there are many generalizations of it, agrees exactly with the formula given by Bekenstein and Hawking. And there's much more. Everything in that region, all the physics in that region, is governed by this infinite dimensional conformal symmetry. And in fact, this is comparing theory to theory, but if you look at these old, anybody who had worked on two-dimensional conformal field theory, if you pull out a page from this seminal paper of Tolkowski and Press, where they solve the problem of scattering off of a black hole, anybody who works on conformal field theory would look at this and say, wait a second, that's a correlation function in a finite temperature two-dimensional conformal field theory. And in fact, that turns out to be true. And we matched up every last parameter in this formula. And so the idea that so this formula can be reproduced from a two-dimensional conformal field theory calculation. Now, of course, these Tolkowski Spress, this was theoretical work. These astronomers are not hoping to scatter light waves off black holes and measure the scattering amplitudes, but they are hoping to do many other things. And so whenever you have a symmetry, as there is for extreme Kerr, you know, there's the possibility of interesting observational signals. And so we've started a search just trying to understand what would we see as astronomical precision increases by leaps and bounds every year. What kinds of things should we hope to expect? And one of the things, one of the things is that it was LISA, now it's ELISA,
they hope to see gravitational waves produced by stellar mass objects forming into a supermassive black hole. Now, if this supermassive black hole happened to be MC 630, so they hope to see a couple of such things every week, you know, if it gets built. If this happened to be M63015, when it falls off the innermost stable circular orbit, plunges into the, you know, near the end there, it is deep within the regime where all the dynamics are governed by conformal symmetry. So this region in the sky where this conformal symmetry controls the dynamics has already been observed. My student Porfiriadis and I worked out what the gravity wave signals should look like for this kind of thing, and we're looking at other kinds of possible signals. I mean, hopefully one would like to find some kind of striking smoking gun for this conformal symmetry, but we haven't done so. Okay, so this relationship between a black hole and a conformal field theory is known as a holographic duality. And you know, it's this basic duality which I talked about in the beginning, where something which black holes are the epitome of, which relate things which are simple to things which are complex, thermodynamics, statistical mechanics, GRS 1915 to a two-dimensional conformal field theory. Now, this general kind of duality has found all, of which the black hole is sort of the essence, has found all kinds of applications, which I'm going to sort of run through quickly. One of the most famous ones and beautiful ones was the application at RIC, where a plausible explanation was given. You know, they were colliding heavy ions at RIC, and surprise, surprise, they made a black hole. And the explanation for the long-lived glueball states was plausibly given, that it had a dual description as literally a black hole. Many, many applications in pure mathematics and algebraic geometry, this duality, though I've just presented cartoons of it here, has very precise mathematical backing to it, and some underpinnings in many cases, and has been used to relate different fields of mathematics. There's a large program which I'm sure you've had colloquia on, called ADS-CMT, which really should be called black hole CMT, not ADS-CMT, because it's a story about infrared phenomena, where problems in condensed matter physics have, with some success, been mapped to problems in black hole physics, including, for example, non-Fermi liquids. One thing that I've been very interested in myself is, this is something that people begin to get inklings of, these people, especially Thibaut d'Amour, in the 70s, that the horizon of a black hole looks like a viscous fluid. If you poke it, the signal dissipates. And from the statistical mechanic point of view, or from the fluid mechanics point of view, that's because it gets transferred into heat. The fluid waves get transferred into heat. And from the black hole point of view, it's just because the stuff falls across the horizon. But this turns out to recently have become completely precise mathematically. And one can show that there's actually a precise mathematical relationship between the Navier-Stokes equation and the Einstein equation. And there was some, just this last year, there's been some beautiful work. Of course, when you relate two things, you can hope to learn about either one from the other. in this subject, I'm guessing that the arrow is going to go from gravity to Navier-Stokes, because the analytic understanding of general relativity is much deeper than of the Navier-Stokes system. There's been some beautiful work in which they numerically reproduce the Kolmogorov exponent from numerical GR. One would like to understand the relationship between cosmic censorship turbulent and global. If you understand this one, you get $1 million. Also try to understand something about turbulence. So there are many more examples. I just really picked a few that I had been involved in myself, but there are many more examples of this kind of approach. But I have a few more minutes, and I want to say some words about string theory and what string theory has to do with all this and how it fits into modern science. Okay, so string theory was discovered 40 years ago, or the modern form of string theory as a theory of quantum gravity was discovered 40 years ago by Shirk and Schwartz. And it was discovered as a solution to the problem of writing some kind of generalized Feynman diagrams or for computing perturbative scattering amplitudes, which could consistently incorporate both quantum mechanics and general relativity. And that was highly non-trivial, because that was a problem that had been recognized in the 50s, and it was very hard to find any sort of solution. Later on, it was realized that it could also naturally include both matter and gauge interactions, and so then it took on a new mantle. This was in the 80s, and this is when it really became of more general interest. It took on a new mantle as not just something to think about if you wanted to put together quantum mechanics and gravity, but as an actual candidate for a unified theory of all the forces and particles of nature. And since that time, it's kind of sprawled out and grown into all different directions and forms a sort of large and web and highly cohesive web of ideas, which incorporates many sort of different ideas. So, in the last few decades, we've learned that string theory can be described in many different ways. We probably, in some ways, like for example, M theory, that don't even involve strings, and so all of these things fit together in one picture. And there aren't really many competitors for string theory because, one of the famous competitors was 11-dimensional supergravity that was shown to be equivalent to string theory. And even gauge theories were shown to be equivalent to string theory. So ideas which seem to be different from string theory turned out to be the same. Now, a notable exception, of course, is loop gravity. But with the incredible group here at Perimeter, I'm hoping that will change soon. But we still call it string theory, even though it's this much bigger subject. The name just kind of sticks. Now, I'm going to present my flow chart of various string theory, of course, is controversial, and I'm going to present my take on the different views on string theory, and I'm going to make a radical proposal. So one view is that string theory is everything. It should explain everything that we see in physics, the electron to muon mass ratio, cosmological constant, everything. And it's a theory of everything. And so we should make a prediction, test well with current experiments. And that leads to anthropic picture. And then that leads to going home and watching TV, because nobody can go. Now, if you like to watch TV, and there's a lot of good stuff on TV these days, there's a much faster route. And that is another, another popular view on string theory, that it's all just sort of mathematical nonsense, disconnected from reality. And then these problems with quantum gravity are, there's no reasonable way to work on them, because we can't do an experiment. And you take that point of view, you can go straight to the TV set. So my radical proposal is that it's not everything, it's not nothing, but it probably is something. And it solves some problems, but not others. And there's a lot of things that we don't understand. And the nice thing about that is you get to go on to the next page, where I'm going to present the string theory report card. Now, there's a lot of controversy about string theory. But I presented this report card a number of times. And sometimes, you know, people really don't disagree very much with the report card. Maybe, you know, one grade should be a little higher or a little lower. People might disagree on what you do with the report card, but they don't. People don't really disagree about what the successes and failures of string theory are. So the first thing here is that it hasn't been ruled out as a theory of nature. And when I first say that, people think I'm being facetious. But I'm really not, because nature is a very peculiar place. And just to give you an idea of how seriously one takes this, you know, as I mentioned a moment ago, nobody worked on, less than 10 people worked on string theory for the first 15 years of its existence, because it was believed that any world described by string theory would have to be parity invariant. And we know that our world is not parity invariant. And so there are many, many ways, our world is rather peculiar. And there are many, many ways that you could rule something out as a complete theory of nature. And the more complete you try to make it, the easier it becomes to rule it out. And the fact that it hasn't been, I think, counts for quite a bit. Unambiguous testable prediction. You know, there are a lot of papers with this prediction, that prediction for string theory. I'm giving this an F. People have made predictions from string theory. Well, of course, nobody ever makes a prediction from string theory. They always make a string theory plus an assumption, which they argue is plausible. There aren't, you know, strings are really small. The Planck length is short. We're not going to make a prediction. Now, what? You can call it a theory if it's wrong. Yes, you can call it a theory. Okay, I think there's an important distinction between a theory which makes a testable prediction and a theory which makes, well, maybe I should have said testable prediction that we would hope to test this century, okay? So I would remind you that I should get my facts right, but I think that the theory that the Earth was round took over 1,000 years to test. But it was a prediction. It was a theory and it was a prediction. There was no conceivable method of testing it when it was made. Is that wrong? You mean because of the No, that wasn't, that didn't settle the issue. You had to go around. Come on. You can't just, that could have just been a local thing. And also the idea, no, nobody bought that. Come on. You had to go around and come around the other side before people believed it. No, I know that. That was the motivation for the conjecture that the Earth was round. Okay, it could have just been a hump. People, if you did a poll at that time on whether the Earth was round, you know, I mean, the idea that the planets go around the sun, that took a long time too. I count Magellan as the evidence that the Earth is round. You know, there could have been an edge to it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of other possibilities. It was a good theory. I made my point. All right. The next ones refine this. So, even though it doesn't make a testable prediction, it could be confirmed in some way. It could have happened that, in some brain world scenario, it could have happened that we turned on the LHC. It could still happen next year. It's not a logical impossibility that we could see Reggie trajectories pointing to the graviton when the LHC vamps up. I'm not holding my breath, but it's a logical possibility. We could still see some kind of long cosmic string in the sky. So there are ways that string theory, that's different than making a prediction, you could see something that would give evidence for it. And okay. So, but still, I don't think that's going to happen. It's not ruled out that it would happen. That's why it's not an F. But it's as bad as it could be without being ruled out. That's a D. Okay, I've argued that we've learned a lot about black holes. That's a B. I think that one complaint I've had about these grades is when mathematicians have been in the audience, they've said this should be an A+. There's no doubt that there's been a lot of interesting inspirations from mathematics. Other kinds of areas like physics, like, you know, like the RIC, the ADS-CMT, it's kind of pretty nice. It's not, could be better. B. Okay, so I want to distinguish between unification and uniqueness. I think it provides a beautiful example of how it could happen in the world that all the particles and forces are unified, but the predictive power of that is diminished by, you know, it's possible, and I'm not even sure how interesting this question is, it's possible that there is only one string theory, but there are certainly many, many phases. And what we care about are the laws of physics, and the laws of physics are different in the different phases, and whether or not string theory is formally unique in some sense, in practice, it's highly non-unique. Okay, some people have claimed, I think string theory has had nothing interesting to say about the cosmological constant problem. Some of my colleagues don't like that. They want me to raise this grade. I don't know. Cosmology is really interesting in it. Seems like the kind of the Big Bang, the origin of the universe. It seems like the kind of thing that string theory should have had something very sharp to say about, but I don't, you know, it hasn't really. And also solving, you know, just constructing a finite perturbation theory, which I call Pauli's renormalizability problem. Even though there isn't a complete analytic proof to all orders in perturbation theory, or the experts argue about whether there's a complete proof, I still will call that an A. So that's my report card. And I'm almost finished here. I think we're on the tip of the iceberg here. We haven't come close to understanding the universality of this area law. And there are really a lot more. So that's the report card. There's still plenty of things, really interesting things to work on. In conclusion, the road to understand nature seldom takes you, it's not a straight path, takes you in many different directions. It's full of twists and turns, and we can't see our way to the end, but we certainly see lots of interesting things just around the bend. So let me stop there.
Okay, so we now have time for questions, and first we open up with the students.
So these chiral CFTs has anomalies, like gravitational anomaly and other anomalies. What is the corresponding phenomena in the Kerr extreme black hole?
The central charge is the anomaly. So it's exactly the anomaly that that governs the density of states. So, in fact, it's exactly that anomaly. The fact that there is anomaly is what enables you to get a lot of mileage from it. So, usually, you know, anomalies are often the only thing that you can compute in a reliable and a universal way, and that's why we were able, because of the existence of this anomaly, it's why we're able to make some mileage on the question.
So if I have a conservative charge, then this anomaly in a CFT means that this charge conservation is broken anomalously when I have an electric field. Then does this happen in this black hole?
In just pure gravity, this conformal field theory wouldn't have any conserved currents, just a stress tensor. And so that would be the only anomaly that you would compute. In other examples, probably there would be some anomalies and you could learn other things from them. Yeah.
Any other question?
So what's your take on firewalls?
What? I don't like them very much. I don't think there's a firewall there. I'm not really an expert on it, though.
In this context, what is your opinion of Stephen Hawking's latest paper on black holes?
You know, I think he there weren't a lot of details in the paper, and you know, it's hard for him to type. I think he has done a lot of great work, and he certainly earned the right to write a short paper like that, to something for us to think about and talk about.
I'm not sure whether your talk actually makes the case that black holes are the harmonic oscillators of the 21st century, or rather conformal field theories might be called the harmonic oscillators of the 21st century.
Well, black holes are conformal field theories.
You just identify the two things, and that's...
many of them are conformal field theories.
But there are CFTs that are not black holes, or maybe not. That would be interesting.
Well, that's right. So, in my talk, I emphasized I was talking about one kind of in the Kerr black, the extreme Kerr black holes. Those are conformal field theories. But for example, the work at RIC, you know, understanding the long-lived states, that was not related to a phase of a black hole in which it looked like a conformal field theory. But it's certainly true that conformal field theories are universal structures that pop up a lot.
Well, a comment and a question. So the comment, I agree with many, many things you said, the report card, general point of view. But perhaps it's worth mentioning that loop quantum gravity was one of the things that was inspired by string theory and was invented as part of an attempt to make sense of string theory. And so I certainly look forward to the bringing them into the picture.
So that's look forward to what?
Bringing them into the picture.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, not everybody agrees with me for sure, but that's been my point of view for a long time. Question, your results on black holes, you emphasize mostly the extreme of black holes.
Right.
What's your view of the progress and the challenges for non-extreme of black holes?
Yeah, so I think we need some I think it's clear that, and this was maybe related to the previous question. We understand conformal field theories, and so we were able to understand black holes when they're conformal field theories. But they don't seem to always be conformal field theories. Like Schwarzschild doesn't really look very much like a conformal field theory. So I mean, I'm not going to say anything useful here, but I think that it really is a new, that we need some, it's going to need some new ideas. You know, that our bag of tricks that we have so far, I don't think is going to enable us to understand Schwarzschild. And more generally, we need to understand, you know, we shouldn't have to, you know, the area law is a universal law. It applies to every horizon. So there should be some way of understanding the area law that doesn't require you to be in some special regime as with extreme Kerr. So on the other hand, I think it's something we're going to be able to understand. I don't think we need to, you know, wait for some experiment, or, I mean, it's a very sharp, well-posed question, and I think that we'll be able to understand it, but I don't think we're, like, on the edge of it. I think there's going to be some new ideas before, we're going to have some new ideas, new ways of looking at things before we get there.
Okay, so Andy is here till Friday afternoon, and as usual, we have a tea and cookies outside waiting for us. Thank you. Let's thank Andy again.